She laughed.
You die trying, I'm afraid. The woman made a scornful noise. Unlikely, she spat out, and then brought the hilt of her knife down hard against Eliana's head. Chapter 15. Riau.
I no longer have a name. I relinquish my casting to its destruction, and forsake the magic with which I was born. I dedicate my mind and body to the guidance of the Church and the study of the Imperium. I no longer have a name. I am only the Archon.
Traditional induction vow of the Archon, leader of the Church of Seldaria. The voice followed Riel back into the waking world, companionable and silent. Strange that a voice could be silent. If it wasn't speaking, yet Riel could sense it beside her, then it wasn't merely a voice. It belonged to someone. A body. A person. And whoever it was, they were close. Who are you? She hoped the voice could hear, and that it couldn't. Had she gone mad? Gently teasing, the voice answered,
I suppose I'll tell you now. You deserve it, Riel. You escaped the mountain, after all.
A smile crept across her lips. Before, the voice had sounded vague, undecipherable, but now, you're a man. An affirmative, soft and playful, almost purring. Riel's smile grew, heat climbing up her cheeks. Do you have a name? She asked.
Of course.
And then Riel felt eyes upon her, though she could see nothing but the churning velvet black of her awakening mind. Cool fingers touched her wrist. Riel stirred, shifted. Tell me. Her voice held an unfamiliar coy lilt. She had spent her childhood cautiously flirting with Tau, with Ludovine, even daring to with Audric from time to time. But this felt different, new, and immense. Please? The voice took a slow breath in, then blew an even slower breath out. A content, sated sound. Not quite a groan, not quite a sigh. Riel's skin prickled, warming.
My name,
said the voice, lips grazing the curve of her ear,
is Corian. Lady Riel, you're awake, and quite pleased with yourself, it seems.
Riel's eyes flew open. A wall of windows framed with drapes in the colours of House Corvery admitted afternoon light. The painted ceiling above her, bordered with gilded moulding, displayed Queen Catel in all her glory. First as a young acolyte in the Seldarian heartlands, then as Saint Catel, driving the angels through the gate, and lastly, crowned and robed, the first queen of Seldaria. Across from Riel sat the Archon, his eyes fixed on Riel, mildly curious. Behind him stood 10 members of the Holy Guard. The 7 temple sigils decorated their gleaming gold armor, echoing the sigils sewn into the Archon's robes. The Holy Guard owed no sense of allegiance to Lord Commander Darden, the King's Guard, the City Guard. They belonged only to the Archon and the Church. Ignoring the anxiety nipping up her arms, Riel sat up and fixed the Archon with a look she hoped was as infuriatingly untroubled as his own. I am indeed pleased, Your Holiness, she said, smiling, for it seems I've successfully completed the first of my trials. If you had stopped an avalanche using only your two hands and the determination of your will, surely you would be proud of yourself as well. She paused. Would this be too much? She couldn't resist. But then, she said, watching the Archon's face, it would be difficult for you to imagine such a thing, since you've given up all rights to your magic. And even before you did, you had to use a casting to access your power. I am burdened by no such constraints. The Archon sat unblinking, his smile small and tight. Riel did not break her stare.
Good, said Corian. Make him sweat.
A door in the wall to Riel's right opened, admitting one of King Bastian's pages. His Majesty is ready for you, Your Holiness.
Excellent, the Archon rose. Lady Darden, follow me.
Riel obeyed, the Holy Guard forming a loose circle around her as she walked. Do they really think I'll lose all sense of reason and kill everyone in my sight? She thought darkly.
Some do, said Corian.
Something about his tone of voice, of thought, startled Riel. You're not just saying that. You know what they think. Silence, then. Corian? Suddenly her heart was a rolling drum in her chest. The impossibility of what was happening felt abruptly, terribly clear. She was talking to a voice in her head, as if this were a normal thing, and had so easily fallen into doing so that already it felt like a long-formed habit. That was not good. The truth returned to her. Mind speak was something the angels once did. Repulsed by herself or by the idea of Corian, Riel couldn't decide. She imagined stepping away from him, shutting herself behind a door, and turning the key. What are you not telling me? She whispered against the lock. Corian's voice came thin and cold.
Pay attention, Riel. Your jailers await. Lady Riel, came the voice of King Bastian, pleasantly enough. You look well, all things considered.
Riel blinked twice, coming back to herself. She stood before a long rectangular table of polished wood. Framed portraits of kings and queens of the Corvary line adorned the far wall. To her right, a wide spread of windows opened to a sun-soaked veranda. This was the king's council hall, where his privy council met. And there was the king himself, with his closest advisers. Queen Genevieve beside him, staring at Riel over the rim of her wine goblet, the Lady of Coin, and the Lord of Letters, the judges of the High Court, appointed by the king. Grand Magister Florimond, the most powerful earthshaker in Seldaria, the woman who had engineered the avalanche. And Riel's father, his face drawn and unreadable. She had not embraced him for years. Yet now, oddly, she found herself craving it. But only for a moment. She raised a cool eyebrow at him and bowed. She caught sight of her ruined boots and realized she was still wearing the clothes from the mountain. Her body chose that moment to make itself known. Every scrape and sprain, every bruise. Her wounds sparked equal parts pain and triumphant pleasure. She had fought the mountain, and won. She straightened once more, pain blooming in her sore shoulders.
Thank you for saying so, Your Majesty, she said. My Queen, my Lord Father, Grand Magister, I am glad to see you all well.
And we are glad to see you well, Lady Darden, King Bastian replied.
Are you?
Her father's head snapped around to glare at her. A throaty chuckle sounded in Riel's mind.
Darling girl.
Riel bit the inside of her lower lip. Forgive me, my king. That was insolent of me. And was it not also insolent, murmured Queen Genevieve, to spend your days endangering my son and niece, without a care as to their safety? Riel stepped forward, outrage spiking in her chest. As one, the king's guard surrounding the room and the holy guard at the Archon's side shifted, hands at their swords. She set her jaw and stood her ground. My queen, I love your son and niece more than anyone in this world. If you think I've spent one moment of my life without thinking of their safety, you are gravely... The slam of a door cut her off. Riel turned to see Audric striding toward her, dark curls falling over his forehead in disarray, and Ludivine just behind him. A wave of such relief washed over Riel that she had to touch the king's table for support. Then Audric was there, gathering her into his arms. Against her matted, mud-crusted hair, he whispered, Riel, they wouldn't let us see you. Tucked safely beneath Audric's chin, Riel let her eyes fall closed and breathed in his familiar sun-spinner scent, the steady warmth of sun-baked stone. And yet here you are.
You're all right? Audric pulled away, searching her face. What happened?
I successfully completed the Earth Trial, Riel answered, unable to stifle a broad smile as she looked up at him. Only 6 more remain.
At Audric's elbow, Ludivine beamed.
Oh, Riel, that's wonderful.
Yes, Grand Magister Florimond and her acolytes created an avalanche, added the Archon. Intended to kill Lady Riel. Obviously, it did not, to our great relief.
He paused.
And to your even greater relief, it seems, my prince.
Riel's cheeks burned, but when she looked past Audric to meet Ludivine's gaze, she saw nothing but love and a warm smile. Audric stepped away from Riel.
My Lord Archon, you mock the life and safety of our Sun Queen. Please, help me understand that. It seems disrespectful at best, and blasphemous at worst.
May I remind you, my son, said Queen Genevieve, that Lady Riel has completed only 1 of 7 trials, and it is not for you to determine whether or not she is the Sun Queen.
Audric's eyes shone, his shoulders square.
She will not merely complete the trials. She will transcend them.
The Archon sniffed.
On what do you base this faith? I've known her all my life. You have known a lie. That's enough, King Bastian clasped his hands on the table. We're not here to argue about the past. We're here to discuss the future.
You're right, father, said Audric, approaching him. Don't make Lady Riel complete the rest of these trials alone, and unprepared.
He looked back at Riel, his expression alight with conviction and belief. Belief in her.
She should complete the trials in front of as many people as possible.
It should be a spectacle,
Grand Magister Florimond agreed, leaning forward to face the king. She was a stout, short woman with ruddy skin and thick brown hair and a crown of braids on her head.
The things Lady Riel accomplished on that mountain...
She shook her head, glanced at Riel.
These are things the people need to see.
Riel felt a flutter of delight at Magister Florimond's awed expression.
Why?
Magister Florimond opened her mouth to speak, then hesitated and glanced at Audric instead.
Because, Audric said, watching his father, when the gate falls and the angels return, the Sun Queen will need the support of the Seldarian people at her back. They need to see her work. They need to love her.
The judges,
The Lord of Letters and the Lady of Coin, even the Queen, shifted uneasily, as did some of the guards stationed around the room. Riel looked to her father. At last, he returned her gaze. She wondered if he was remembering the same thing she was. Secret evenings in Tal's office, after a day of lessons. Riel on her father's knee, and slowly reading the words of Ayava's prophecy aloud. Two queens will rise, one of blood, one of light. She had been young enough then, and perhaps not yet frightening enough, that her father still touched her with something like affection.
Audric, said King Bastian tightly, I would ask you not to speak of such things right now. But it's precisely now that we must speak of these things.
Audric's voice was taking on that earnest, gruff quality it had whenever he went off on one of what Riel and Ludovine called his scholarly fits. Despite everything, Riel glanced sidelong at Ludovine, who was stifling her own smile.
Princess Runa's death, Audric continued. The slave uprisings in Kyrvaia, the unprecedented storms across the ocean, in Meridian and Venterra. The shifting mountains in the old angelic lands, displacing entire villages overnight. And now, he said, looking back at Riel, there's Lady Riel. Maybe those assassins knew something we didn't, and their attempt to kill me was really an attempt to draw out her power for all to see. Or maybe it was simply coincidence. Either way, we cannot ignore the timing of these events.
Audric returned his impassioned gaze to the king.
The angel Ayava knew centuries ago. He warned us of this time, and now it is upon us.
King Bastian's normally open expression was a barred door.
That's enough, Audric. Father, we ignore the signs at our peril.
The king rose to his feet.
That's enough!
Audric stepped back, meeting his father's glare for one searing moment before looking at the floor.
The Archon cleared his throat. Perhaps there is some wisdom to the prince's suggestions. Whether or not the prophecy's events are unfolding before us, if Lady Riel is forced to complete the trials in plain view of the Seldarian people.
Then the challenge will be even greater for me, Riel interrupted. And you will know I am not to be feared.
She took Aldric's place before his father, her heart pounding fast and sure.
For I'll be not only fighting for my life, but for theirs as well.
That, said King Bastian, is a terrible risk.
Queen Genevieve set down her goblet with some force.
A risk we cannot take. My love, this is nonsense. The city guard, Riel insisted. The royal guard, the holy guard, every acolyte from the temples. All of them can be on alert, ready, in case I falter.
She took a deep breath.
But I won't falter. I've been taught well by my father, and by Tal.
Taught, while hidden within secrets and lies, the Archon added.
Riel ignored him.
They can continue my lessons, with the help of everyone, on the Magisterial Council.
She glanced at Grand Magister Florimond. The woman inclined her head.
I, for one, will be glad to help Lady Riel in this.
Riel gave her a small smile.
Word will get out, my king, about the trials, about me. Too many people know what's happening for rumors not to escape. Think about how our people will react if they find you've been keeping such a secret from them. Enough lies have been told, enough secrets kept. I had a part in that, and I don't wish to any longer.
King Bastian returned to his seat, considering her in silence.
If we tell the people everything, Audric added, coming to stand beside her,
And if they can see Riel's power and control for themselves, said Ludovine, on Riel's other side.
Then that will show them you trust her.
And they, in turn, will trust her, Ludovine added. And you as well, Uncle. And, finished Riel, if there are dark turnings elsewhere in the world, perhaps they will then think twice about setting their sights on Seldaria. If they know we are united. If there are no secrets to exploit.
If, King Bastian said slowly, they see that we have the most powerful human to ever live as our guardian.
Corian at last returned.
He's not wrong, came his low voice. There has never been a human like you, Riel. And there never will be.
Riel fought to keep her smile hidden. That, she sensed, would not help her case. Finally, King Bastian took a deep breath and reclined in his chair.
You three,
he said, looking at Riel, Audric, and Ludovine in turn.
Have had far too much practice concocting schemes together. It is difficult to argue with such a front.
My love, began Queen Genevieve urgently.
It's settled then.
King Bastian placed his palms flat on the table.
The remaining 6 trials will be public events, open to all. What did you call it, Bridia? A spectacle?
Grand Magister Florimond inclined her head.
Perhaps too flippant a word.
No, it is a good word. A celebratory word, and that's what this will be. A celebration of Seldaria's might and the power of its citizens.
King Bastian looked to his son.
A clear sign to every soul living that Seldaria is not afraid of strange storms, or shifting lands, or old tales of death and doom that have no bearing on our future.
For a moment, Riel feared Audric would say something else, further invite his father's anger. But then King Bastian left the room, his king's guard flanking him. The others followed shortly after, Audric hurrying out after his mother, and Riel's own father disappearing before she had the chance to speak to him.
Well,
Ludovine said brightly. She grabbed Riel's hands and grinned.
I don't know about you, but after that, I could use a drink.
Chapter 16 Eliana. Lift your eyes to the eastern skies. Wait for the sun, and with it rise. We will march down the roads gone black with the dead. We will tear down their walls and paint their crowns red. A rowing song composed by suspected Red Crown ally Yosef Ferrakora during the siege of Arxara Bay. Eliana awoke beneath a threadbare quilt in a small dark room to the unwelcome sight of Simon sitting near her. He reclined on a wooden chair, one long leg resting on the other, and held a glass of reeking alcohol. Eliana sat up, remembering to grit her teeth as if the pain from the blow to her head had lingered.
You have 5 seconds to tell me where we are and where Remy is, she said smoothly, and who knocked me on the head, and where I can find them, before I disembowel you.
And good morning to you, dearest Dread,
said Simon, with a salute of his glass.
I must say, you are looking particularly, well, dreadful, if you'll forgive the joke.
Where are my knives? She realized with a jolt of shock that she was no longer wearing her ruined party gown. In fact, she was no longer wearing anything, except for the pendant around her neck.
You piece of shit, she said quietly. Where are my clothes?
Where are my knives? And where is my brother? Remy is safe and sleeping. Navi as well, if you're curious, though I'm sure you're not.
Simon tossed her a heap of clothes.
Aster wanted to tend to your wounds and get that blood-soaked gown off you. Maybe to make up for her sister knocking you on the head and then, it seems, drugging you? I scolded Marigold roundly for wasting quality goods on you, but she was unrepentant.
Eliana picked up the tunic he had tossed her, grimacing at the frayed hems and patched sleeves. Who is Marigold?
Aster's sister. Try to keep up.
He knocked back the rest of his drink and set down the glass.
Anyway, every time Aster tried to dress you, you kicked her. But worry not. She's a tough one.
She glared at him until he said,
Ah,
and turned around to face the wall.
Interestingly, he continued, you had no wounds that Aster could see.
Eliana's pulse quickened. She tugged on underwear, undershirt, and trousers, too baggy for her, not to mention fusty and faded, but at least they were clean.
Disappointed that I was lucky enough to emerge unscathed from our valiant escape, she pulled on the stained linen tunic. I bet you'd love to have seen my body marked head to toe with scars to match your own, wouldn't you?
Actually, Simon replied, I wouldn't.
She waited for elaboration, and when none came, she examined the jacket he'd brought her, a moth-eaten, bell-sleeved affair with a dull embroidered collar that had once certainly been gaudy and now looked simply pathetic.
Decent clothes aren't something you rebels care much about finding, I suppose, she muttered, nevertheless shrugging on the jacket.
If you're finished.
She made quick work of her wild hair, braiding it into submission.
Give me my knives, and I'll refrain from hitting you for at least 5 minutes.
Have you always been this unspeakably irritating?
Has your face always looked so temptingly carvable?
You want to know where we are?
Simon said, gesturing toward the door. She pushed past him into a dim stone hallway. A path of wooden planks lined the earthen floor. Following the distant sound of conversation, she turned a corner, passed two doors set clumsily into the wall, and emerged onto a wooden platform, overlooking an underground pit. The walls glistened from the slow drip of water. The pit's floor was covered in people, refugees, clothed in rags, faces dark and pale, grown and young, all marked with dirt, ash, and blood. And around the perimeter, standing watch on platforms, moving through the gathered refugees with supplies and stretchers, were rebels. Some wore rifles strapped to their backs. Others carried daggers at their waists. Suddenly, Eliana felt neither tired nor irritated. Simon had brought her to a Red Crown encampment. Immediately, she leaned against the platform's railing, as if overwhelmed by the sight laid out before her. She let out a sigh of pity, just loud enough for Simon to hear, and she began counting. Two rebel soldiers patrolling the pit's floor, six more distributing supplies, five platforms around the room, one soldier stationed at each, an open crate of potatoes against a nearby stretch of wall, a dozen more, similarly marked, stacked beneath that. Simon came to stand beside her. His scarred hands rested on the railing next to her own. The pit's size? She measured quickly, maybe 1,000 square feet and 20 feet deep. The number of refugees inside it? 300, give or take.
Speechless, Dredd, said Simon. Allow me a moment of shock.
She stepped away from him. What is this place? She let her words carry a small tremor. Enough for Simon to maybe wonder, has the Dredd's heart been touched by the sight of such sprawling misery? Ah, she thought, but the Dredd has no heart.
Crown's Hollow, Simon moved toward a set of stairs at the side of their platform. Come, I'll show you.
She didn't follow him, let some fear rise into her eyes so he'd think her nervous.
Tell me here.
This is not Orlean, Dredd. Follow me, or Red Crown will make your life as miserable as you've made theirs.
Her laugh was shrill, unconvincing.
Underestimate me, Wolf. I dare you to do it. That would take some doing.
You've made this war a game for yourself. But here it is not a game. Not for these people. And if you flaunt your kills in front of them, I will show you no mercy.
The ferocity in his voice startled her. For a moment, Eliana could find nothing to say. Then she said scornfully,
"You think you know me,"
and moved to join him.
"But you're wrong." "And you don't know this war," Simon countered. "You will, though. And soon. Consider this an introduction."
He said nothing else, and she was glad, for as they descended into the crowd of people, she could think only of the stench and the low buzz of too many living, breathing humans crammed into too small a space. Children huddled in makeshift tents. A woman sharpened her knives as a tiny girl at her knee watched, wide-eyed. A young man read to his dozing companion by the light of a dying fire. The air was a sea of sweat and filthy clothes and sewage. Worse than that, though, was the unifying expression the refugees wore. There was a hollowness to their faces, a hunger, an exhaustion that pushed at Eliana's ribs and turned her throat sour. She couldn't imagine what they had seen, and she didn't care to. She had her own past of horrors to contend with, her own sleepless nights.
"How can you live with it?" Harkon had asked her, when they were both 12 years old.
He had recently learned what Eliana was training to do, and seemed to be struggling with how to talk around her, now that he knew what she could do with a knife.
"With what?"
she had asked, concentrating on cleaning the set of blades her mother had purchased for her.
"First they must be cleaned," Rosen had told her. "Take your time. Get to know them. They will need names."
"Names?" Eliana had asked, giggling.
"Yes,"
Rosen had answered, her gaze the tiniest bit sad.
"They will be the truest friends you ever have."
"How can you live with knowing that you'll kill people?"
Harkin had nervously watched her work.
"Good people."
"It's easy," Eliana had replied.
Back then, the gravity of what she was doing had sat heavy in her stomach, like a stone in a never-ending sea. But her mother had instructed her that if she didn't learn to tuck away that sick feeling, it would consume her. So Eliana tried on the face she had been practicing in the mirror every morning. Thoughtless, bored, sly. And said to Harkon,
"It's the only way to stay alive."
Harkon had shaken his head and looked away, as if the sight of her was something he could no longer bear.
"I don't know what's happening to you,"
he had whispered. But he had stayed nonetheless, helped her clean her blades, and name them.
"Arabeth,"
he'd suggested for the wicked, jagged one, even allowing a ghost of a smile when Eliana approved. Once that was done, he'd crawled into bed and held her until falling asleep. But Eliana had not slept that night. She'd lain there beside Harkon, her eyes squeezed shut, wishing she would wake up in the morning and all would be as it should. Her father would return home, the empire would be gone, and King Maximilian would still be alive. Harkon would look at her like she was his friend again, and not something terrible and new.
"Saint Catel," Eliana had prayed, "hear my prayer. Send us the warmth of your wisdom. Light the dark path before me. Bind the Sun Queen. Tell her we're waiting. Tell her we need her."
She had turned her face into her pillow, tears coursing silently down her cheeks.
"Tell her I need her."
In the dim light of Crown's Hollow, Eliana focused on the back of Simon's head.
"How can you live with knowing that you'll kill people? Good people."
She ignored the murmuring refugees at her feet and told herself,
"Don't look at them. Don't look. Don't."
Instead, she listened to the rebels bustling through the crowd, passing out food, standing bored on the platforms, squeezing through the narrow spaces between the pit walls and high stacks of crated supplies. They began to drop whispered treasures.
Lord Mowbray arrives tomorrow. The raid, 2 miles northeast.
Lord Mowbray, Eliana knew the name, one of the Empire's roaming royalty. He moved from village to village, outpost to outpost. Something brushed Eliana's wrist. She flinched away and looked down. A refugee woman with a black scarf tied around her wrinkled, pale head reached for Eliana with a watery smile. Her arm was mottled with burn scars, skin shining taut in the spotty firelight. Eliana barely resisted the urge to slap her.
Don't look at them. Don't look. Don't.
Simon, however, gently grasped the woman's hand and knelt down to speak to her. Eliana looked away, arms folded tightly across her chest. A hot wave of anger rose up her throat, that the woman had dared to touch her, that Eliana had wanted to slap her, that Eliana hadn't slapped her. That this room was crowded with people too weak to make a life for themselves in the Empire's world, and that Simon was forcing her to walk among them. She stepped away to lean against a column of rock, gazing about the room with practiced disinterest, while her mind kept counting. 4 doors up above, by the platforms, and 4 more on the floor level. One stood maybe 20 feet away. Where did they lead? Tunnels? A pair of rebels exited the nearest door, arms packed with folded bandages. Eliana lowered her head as they approached, hunched her shoulders, closed her eyes. A dozing refugee, tired and alone. That's all she was.
Monday morning, whispered one of them, hurrying by. We'll blow them all to the deep. Let the angels wrestle with his lordship for a while, the second rebel guffawed.
Nobody talked about angels without it being a joke. Not unless you were mad or a child who believed the old stories.
Like Remy.
Eliana listened closely as the rebels passed.
Not sure even the angels deserve Lord Mowbray among them, said the first.
And then they had passed out of hearing range. So, she would need to give Simon the slip and roam about until she found someone willing to confirm the scattered bits of information. But if it was true, tomorrow morning Lord Mowbray would arrive at an Empire outpost 2 miles northeast of Crown's Hollow. And the day after, the rebels would raid the facility, taking down one of the Empire's strongholds. What to do with that knowledge, if anything, Eliana didn't know, but she filed it away with a smug twinge of satisfaction.
Contemplating your vile past, Eliana opened her eyes and shot Simon a nasty smile.
Finish chatting with your girlfriend,
Simon gestured toward the nearby door, which stood slightly ajar.
After you,
she pushed off the wall.
So, where do they come from, these refugees of yours?
They come from everywhere. Ventera, Meridian, even from as far south as the Vespers, if they have a strong enough boat.
And you feed and house them? Treat their wounds and illnesses?
At the door, Simon stopped her with a touch on her arm. She turned back to him with a coy grin, but the innuendo on her lips died at the look on his face. He considered her in silence, like he was trying not only to read her face, but to look even past that and find a deeper truth.
Look all you want, she thought savagely. You'll find nothing good.
Yes, he said at last. We treat their wounds and illnesses.
Eliana ignored the disquiet in her belly, gave him a slight hard smirk.
There are many such Red Crown camps throughout the country, I assume.
Yes.
Your rebellion might be more successful if you didn't spend so much time nursing the damned.
The door before them opened.
Revolutions,
mean nothing if their soldiers forget to care for the people they're fighting to save," said a new voice.
Two men stood there, and a woman. The man who had spoken was short, slight, pale-skinned, with wild copper hair, and when Eliana's gaze dropped to his waist, where a small sword hung in plain view, the man clucked his tongue.
"Uh-uh,"
he said, wagging his finger at her.
"There will be no violence tonight."
"Give me my knives and my brother, or I'm afraid I'll be forced to disobey."
Eliana clucked her tongue.
"And I was so hoping we could be friends."
The other man, tall and muscular, with dark skin and black hair, cropped close to his head, moved his hand to the revolver at his belt.
"Don't bother," said the first man, placing a hand on the other's arm. "She's afraid, and lashing out."
Eliana burst out laughing.
"You think I'm afraid?"
"Everyone's afraid. You're just better at hiding it than most."
The man's eyes flicked to Simon.
"So Simon says, at least."
Eliana's laughter died, but a deadly smile remained.
"I don't believe we've been introduced."
"Ah, of course. How rude of me. I am Patrick, and I oversee Crown's Hollow. This is Hob," he said, gesturing to the other man. "My lieutenant, and also my husband. And I believe you've already met Marigold," he added, gesturing to the woman on his left. She was older, with weathered brown skin and grey braids, and a malicious gleam in her eye.
"I hit you on the head,"
Eliana grinned.
"And I'll soon return the favor."
Patrick clasped Eliana's hand, gave it a firm shake.
"And of course I know you, Eliana Ferracora. Yes, I know exactly who you are."
When he smiled at her, it was not without kindness, but Eliana knew the glint of a killer when she saw one.
"Cause trouble in my home," he said cheerfully, "and I will cut you from skull to navel, no matter how much I like your brother, and no matter how much Simon likes you."
Simon gave a dismissive scoff. But Patrick was already guiding Eliana through the door.
"Now then," he announced with a clap of his hands, "who's hungry?"
Chapter 17. Riel.
I worry about Riel. All children have tempers, but hers comes with a certain look I have not seen on the faces of others her age, or even much older. Her rage holds a delight, a hunger, that I'll confess sometimes keeps me awake through the night. I haven't talked to my husband about it. Sometimes I think I'm jumping at shadows. I should not be writing this. In fact, I think I will burn it. Journal of Maurice Dardenne, confiscated by the Church of Seldaria, in the year 998 of the Second Age.
"Again,"
Riel exhaled sharply, blowing a sweaty dark curl out of her eyes, pushed hard off the ground and jumped, first over a boulder, then over a pile of wooden rails. Then she scrambled up the rocky slope, past the rails and down the steeper other side.
"Don't lose the pole," she told herself. "Don't lose the pole."
She made it to the bottom, dropped to her belly, and slid under the net into the mud pit. If she touched the wide weave net stretching above her, she'd have to start over at the beginning of the course, and her father would add another stone to her pack. She'd made it halfway through before her hands slipped, and she fell chin first into the mud. Inhaling a mouthful, she choked and gagged.
"Up!"
barked a voice from above. She bit back a curse. Of course he would choose that moment for a fight. She found an opening in the net, and crawled up through it, maneuvering her long wooden pole free, just in time for her father's attack. His own pole flew fast at her shoulders. She ducked, raised her pole, and swung it around to strike. The poles met with a sharp wooden crash that hurt Riel's teeth. She swayed, lost her footing, caught herself on the net.
"Get up!"
Her father's pole swung again, rapped hard against her knuckles.
"Damn it!"
She bit back smarting tears of pain and lunged to her feet, swinging wildly.
"I was down!"
But her feet got caught in the netting, and she tripped and fell hard on her tailbone.
"And you're down again!"
Her father made a soft sound of disgust and flung his pole to the grass outside the pit.
You didn't even make it to the wall climb that time. Get up and go back to the beginning.
Riel rose to her feet, shaking with exhaustion and rage. She kept her eyes to the ground, ignoring her ever-present guard, which stood silently around the obstacle course her father had engineered. If they thought she looked ridiculous, well, they weren't wrong. The course Riel had described to Audric and Ludovine as her woodland torture chamber lay in a secluded area of the foothills of Sibylline, the highest mountain in Seldaria. The saints had constructed Catel's castle, Banegard, upon its slopes centuries before. Every day for 6 days straight, in preparation for the next trial, Riel had met her father here. To strengthen her body, he'd said, and improve her agility. So far, all it had done was make her sore, and angry as the darkest corner of the deep.
I'm not an athlete! She spat at her father, picking her way out of the mud pit and tossing her pole away. Nor am I a warrior!
He let out a sharp laugh.
Never has anything been so clear as that!
And yet you insist on putting me through this for hours!
She marched across the grass, peeling off her mud-soaked gloves, gauntlets, shin guards, and at last the cursed, heavy pack of stones.
We've been out here since dawn, she muttered. I should be studying with Tal by now, practicing with Grand Magister Rosier. Water's always been my weakest element, or I could be working on my costume with Ludovine.
A costume, her father scoffed. Yes, a wise use of your time, that.
Ludovine's idea and a good one. If I want our people to love me,
he laughed again, soft and unkind,
and show them I'm not afraid.
Even you're not that good a liar.
Stop interrupting me!
He fell silent, glaring at her. She glared right back, heat climbing up the back of her neck, up her arms, coiling in her belly. Her father glanced at her hands, but she kept them clenched tight. She knew what he was looking for. Wild sparks, the birth of a fire that would rage out of control and consume everything in its path. As she fought back tears, fists clenched at her sides, she wished, not for the first time, that her father had been the parent she had killed, and that her mother had lived.
If you are to have any chance of surviving these trials, he said at last, if you want to have more than raw power and dumb luck on your side, then you will need to become stronger, and quickly.
I've been studying for years, working on my control with Tal.
And that may not be enough.
Riel stood her ground even as he advanced upon her. She could feel her braid slipping, sense how sloppy and small and foolish she appeared next to Lord Commander Dardenne. The man, somehow, looked unruffled even in his muddy training uniform. She bit down hard on her tongue.
This is no joke, Riel, her father continued.
He re-knotted the ties, holding the thin leather padding in place around her torso, straightened her collar, tucked loose hairs back into her braid so roughly that it hurt her scalp.
The Earth Trial was nothing compared to what the Magisterial Council will engineer for you next. This is only the beginning of a long, hard path. Your life as you knew it is now over. You understand this?
Riel's cheeks flamed. What must her guard think of him, scolding her as he would a small child?
Yes, father, she said quietly. I understand.
If you fail, they will kill you. They might kill me and Tal as well.
Riel looked at her boots through a film of tears.
I've thought of that.
Have you? We can't know the council's mind, nor the king's. These are extraordinary circumstances.
Yes, father.
He removed one of his gloves, used his bare hand to turn up her chin. She stared at him, eyes full, until his mouth twisted and he walked away. He sat on the ground by the mud pit, found his canteen in the grass, and took a swig of water.
Sit,
he said, handing the canteen to her.
Drink.
She obeyed, saying nothing. As she drank, she stole glances at her father, noting the grey at his temples and peppering his thick, dark hair, the lines around his stern mouth. She realized with a swift turn of sorrow that she couldn't remember what he used to look like, before her mother's death had stolen his smile.
Do you remember?
She asked.
That lullaby Mama sang to me?
Her father was gazing out at the mud-spattered obstacle course, the unsmiling ring of soldiers around it, the dense pine forest beyond that. Riel watched him, examining his profile. She ached, suddenly, to hold his hand and ask him if he was as afraid as she was. She curled her fingers through the grass instead.
I don't remember any lullaby,
he answered, tonelessly. Riel couldn't be sure if that was a lie or not, but she nodded anyway and looked out into the forest just as he did. She drew in a deep breath and began to sing.
By the moon, that's where you'll find me. By the moon, we'll hold hands, just you and me. We'll pray to the stars and ask them to set us free. By the moon, that's where you'll find me.
When a few moments of unbearable silence had passed, she added,
I can't always remember things about her. How she smelled, the feel of her hands. But I remember her voice. And I remember that song.
As soon as the words left her lips, her father rose to his feet, dusted off his trousers, retrieved her pack of stones, and handed it to her. She could read nothing on his face except for the same quiet resolve it always wore, the certainty of Riel's wrongness and of his own long suffering at her hands.
Again, he said, back to the beginning.
Riel didn't know how many people were outside waiting to watch her battle the ocean, but from the sound of them, it must have been a lot. She shifted in her new boots and fought the urge to fiddle with the hem of her heavy cloak, the cords of which she had tied around her throat and torso, to keep her costume hidden until the last minute. The costume had been Ludovine's idea. Keeping it hidden had been Audric's. Ludovine had tugged Audric proudly into her rooms late last night, once her tailors had completed their final fitting and proclaimed, beaming,
Isn't she stunning, Audric?
Riel had made herself look right at him. Why wouldn't she? There was nothing strange about showing off her fancy new trial costume to one of her oldest friends. Was there? But her cheeks had burned, her heart pounding so fast she thought she might choke on it. And then, he'd suggested,
I don't think you should show your costume until the very last moment.
Surprised, she had managed to ask, Why? He'd smiled softly at her.
Because then they'll spend the whole trial hoping desperately that you survive. If only so they'll have the chance to see you again.
Riel shivered now to think of his soft words. Outside, Grand Magister Rosier's voice boomed over the forged amplifier.
My brothers and sisters, citizens of Seldaria, a few words before the trial begins.
As he described the trial and its rules, and reminded everyone that there was no need to worry for their safety, every acolyte from his temple was in attendance, ready to harness the waves should the candidate lose control. Riel closed her eyes and recited the water rite under her breath.
O seas and rivers, O rain and snow, quench us our thirst, cleanse us our evil.
The flap of her holding tent opened.
And here I thought you hated praying.
Tal!
She turned into his arms without a second thought, blinking back a rush of tears.
I thought you said the Archon wouldn't let you see me alone.
Sloane's just outside.
He stroked her hair, kissed her brow.
In her endless generosity, she's allowed us 2 minutes to talk.
I heard that,
came Sloane's dry voice from outside. Riel closed her eyes, breathing deeply. Tal smelled of firebrand smoke and temple incense, a welcome contrast to the briny salt stench of the ocean outside. She could almost pretend they were back in his office, ready for a lesson.
"I do hate praying," she said, pulling back with a tight smile. "But right now, I'll try anything." Tao carefully searched her face.
"You're frightened."
"Frightened? Me?"
She shrugged, trying not to let her teeth chatter. Why did the ocean make everything feel so damned cold?
"It's just that some stuffy old magister once told me praying helps my concentration."
Tao smiled sadly, then scrubbed a hand over his stubbled cheeks.
"I can't believe this is happening. I keep waiting to wake up."
"Don't start moaning to me. I'm the one about to do this, not you."
"You're right."
He folded her hands into his own, bent down to look her in the eye.
"I'm sorry, love. I just wish we'd had more time."
A horn blasted outside, reminding Riel of the boon chase starting line. That day already seemed ages past. The thought that she had been scared of a horse race was enough to make her want to laugh. Or maybe cry.
"Lady Riel,"
the head of her personal guard, assigned to her by the king, opened the tent flap. She was a solid, broad-shouldered woman named Eveline, whose pale face wore a permanent stern frown.
"They're ready for you."
Riel stole one last glance at Tao. She knew what he was thinking. She was remembering the same thing.
"Let's go over here, Riel. Here, under the willow tree, where the water is warm and quiet."
Tao's hands tight around her throat, holding her under. She shuddered, swallowing hard.
"Don't hesitate to fight this time," Tao said softly,
his hands flexed at his sides, as if he longed to reach for her.
"This is not about proving yourself. This is about staying alive."
"No one knows that better than I do," she replied. "Lady Riel?"
Without another word, she stepped past Tao and stone-faced Sloane, who surprised her by grabbing her hand and gently pressing her palm.
"Be safe," Sloane murmured.
Then Riel emerged into the sun. Spectators sat in hastily erected wooden stands surrounding the bay, the nearest ones close enough that Riel could clearly see the curiosity and suspicion on their faces. There must have been hundreds of them, thousands, practically the entire capital, and anyone who'd heard about the trials and was able to travel to the coastal city of L'Occitane in time. They were all watching her, in silence. Her guard following close behind, she walked to the edge of the pier and forced her head high beneath the hood of her cloak. A lonely gull cried out overhead. At the edge of the pier stood two acolytes, their castings in hand, a broadsword and a metal disc engraved with waves. The horn sounded a second time. One more, and she would begin. She gazed out over the water, a wide bay encircled by low, black cliffs. The water was calm as glass. But it would not be calm for long.
"Well," said Corian, "here we are."
She almost jumped out of her skin.
"Corian, I haven't heard from you since..."
She set her jaw against the sudden, wild hope that he could somehow provide her with an exit from this horrible day.
"I can't stop this. You've played right into their hands."
"I don't want you to stop this,"
he chuckled lightly.
"You can't lie to me."
She loosened the ties of her cloak.
"I'm showing them they have no reason to fear me. They will love me for it."
"They will kill you for it."
"If all you're going to do is try to make me afraid," she told him icily, "then stay away from me."
"I'm trying to help you see the truth."
She stepped forward and let her cloak fall to the ground. The crowd gasped. Murmurs broke out like waves cresting across the shore. Riel couldn't help a small, genuine smile. She knew the costume was a good one. A form-fitting suit made from a stylish, brightly colored new fabric Ludovine had ordered from Mazabat. It would keep her warm in the water, but was flexible enough for her to swim with ease. Waves embroidered with glittering thread swirled across the fabric in the temple colors of the baths, slate blue and sea foam, and the fabric itself.